4. Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Liz Pelka reporting. Hundreds of thousands of people marched in cities across the U.S. Saturday to demand changes to gun policy. From Washington, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
It's a movement for kids and by kids. Started after a gunman shot 17 people to death at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida on Valentine's Day. Across the U.S., students, parents, teachers, and other activists took to the streets to demand policymakers implement stricter gun control measures.
The school in Florida where this happened is very similar in demographic and in financial income as the town that I live in. And to see that something like that could happen in a town that's just like mine is really scary for me as a student.
Not everyone agrees, however, with the aim of the march.
You know, the right to own firearms is a right enshrined in our Constitution, and I feel like this march is not going to solve anything.
But for those participating in the event, they hope the momentum continues. Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
A special mass was held Sunday in the southwestern town of Trèbes, France, to honor the 4 killed and 3 wounded in Friday's terror attack. That included an officer who swapped himself with a hostage in a supermarket.
Il vaut mieux qu'un seul meure pour le peuple. Et que la nation ne périsse pas.
The Bishop of Carcassonne and Narbonne praised Gendarme Lieutenant Colonel Arnaud Beltram's extraordinary devotion. The bishop also said Friday's events offered an opportunity to reflect on the suffering felt by countless people around the world. The Islamic State militant group's propaganda arm claimed responsibility. 2 car bombs in the Somali capital of Mogadishu killed 6 people and injured at least 5 others on Sunday, according to witnesses. This comes 3 days after 17 people were killed. I'm Liz Palka. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday rebuffed the notion he is having trouble assembling a top legal team to defend him as the FBI investigates allegations that his 2016 campaign colluded with Russia to help him win. President Trump tweeting Sunday, "Many lawyers and top law firms want to represent me in the Russia case." This comes as Trump's lead lawyer, John Dowd, quit last week while another top Washington lawyer declined to join Trump's defense. The president has repeatedly denied any campaign collusion with Russia. Crowds clashed with police in Barcelona on Sunday as Catalans protested the arrest of fugitive former regional leader Carles Puigdemont in Germany. Puigdemont was detained on Sunday by German police, who were executing an international warrant issued by Spain on Friday. He was returning from Finland to Belgium, where he fled following an illegal declaration of independence by the Spanish region in October. The schoolgirls kidnapped by the Boko Haram jihadist group in northeastern Nigeria were reunited with their families on Sunday. They spent nearly 5 weeks in captivity. The 105 girls arrived aboard 5 buses in the town of Dapchi, where they were greeted by their parents at their boarding school. After their release last Wednesday, they spent 3 days in the capital, where they were greeted by President Muhammadu Buhari. Pope Francis marked Palm Sunday in Rome's St. Peter's Square, urging young people not to let themselves be manipulated. Sabino Castelfranco has more for VOA.
In his homily, Pope Francis told young people that the temptation to silence them has always existed.
Ci sono molti modi per rendere i giovani silenziosi e invisibili.
The Pope said there are many ways to silence young people and make them invisible, many ways to anesthetize them, to make them keep quiet, ask nothing, question nothing. Pope Francis urged young people to keep shouting and not allow the older generations to silence their voices. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The large crowd celebrating Mass included many young people who turned out to celebrate the Catholic Church's World Day of Youth. British regulators are examining evidence gathered at the offices of data research firm Cambridge Analytica, which allegedly acquired illegal data of an estimated 50 million Facebook users to build profiles for U.S. political campaigns, including the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. More on VOAnews.com. I'm Liz Palka reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Our campaign still continues to go on as required, as we have set up the timetable with the commission. And today is the last day for our campaign in the Western area, and we continue with that.
The Sierra Leonean main opposition party continues with campaign plans despite an injunction on Tuesday's presidential election runoff.
The president took over. When we met him, he said it was unacceptable that Chibok happened, and then that she has happened. So it's unacceptable that that she has happened, and we will not wait until something else happens again. So that's why we're going to court.
Bring Back Our Girls campaign group threatens to sue the Nigerian government for what it says is the administration's shifting explanation of the Dapchi schoolgirls' release.
Mnangagwa himself can establish a majority because it's unlikely, given that the alliance and Mujuru and the new national front are now in the contestation. So really, it's going to be a really fragmented contest out there.
And a splinter group from the Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF party promises to soon announce its leadership structure. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Sierra Leonean People's Party, or SLPP, says it will continue with its campaign plans across the country ahead of Tuesday's presidential runoff poll. This, despite the High Court's injunction placed on the election. The opposition party says its presidential candidate, former military ruler Brigadier Julius Madabio, will not be deterred in his determination to win the runoff vote. The High Court's ruling prevents the National Electoral Commission from organizing the presidential runoff scheduled for Tuesday. For reaction to the High Court's ruling, I reached Lahai Lawrence Lima, spokesman for the main opposition SLPP.
Well, in the first place, we consider it as an abuse of process and the APC government lack of commitment to the elections. But we as a party very much committed to the electoral process, and we view that injunction as a pattern or a strategy to delay the electoral process. But we are very much committed, and we have told our members to actually find themselves to the stations where they register and get prepared for the elections on Tuesday.
Is the SLPP continuing to campaign in readiness for the election despite the injunction?
We have not received any letter or instructions from the commission that we should stop our activity. Our campaign still continues to go on as required, as we have set up the timetable with the commission. And today is the last day for our campaign in the Western area, and we continue with that.
Some people are expressing concern that Sierra Leoneans are worried there is increased tension because of this injunction the High Court placed on Tuesday's presidential runoff vote. What are you telling your supporters and the people of Sierra Leone ahead of Monday's possible ruling and then Tuesday's election?
Well, that is sufficient enough to send a message to the government that the people are yearning for change, and he must respect the voices of the people. It is one man who is a member of the APC that is seeking his own interest in the court, and the court had not been considerate enough to consider the position of 3 million population as against the interest of one person. So we would call on our supporters and members to go to the court, because it's a public hearing, to go to the court. So we are going to hear the matter, how it comes out on Monday.
Some people are saying the ruling shows the independence of the Sierra Leonean judiciary, and that the court really stamped its authority to ensure that the process, as you said, is respected. How do you respond to that?
Well, it is President Nkrumah who is not committed to respecting the independence of the judiciary. And we find ourselves in a country where a lot of people who find themselves in independent institutions are very timid to stand for their independence mandate. And that's where we find ourselves. When instructions come from the president, as the popular or cliche man, slogan around, orders from above, it's very difficult to see people going against that backdrop. We saw a situation where the vice president of this republic was also deposed from office, and the court was also timid to pass a verdict that is very much unpopular until the ECOWAS has to overturn that. An injunction was not placed when the vacuum actually created in the office of the vice president. An injunction was not slammed by the court. They said that will also undermine national security. And if elections business has to do with the security of the state. It has the potential to undermine the security of the state if the election does not go on Tuesday, when President Kumar's mandate or legitimacy will expire finally on Tuesday. Then it has the strong potential to undermine national security. And President Kumar must realize the fact that he entered power through peaceful transfer of power, and that he must respect it and leave as the only legacy after he has failed the people of this country by rampant corruption and also abuse of offices, and particularly so the independence of state institutions. And he should not use state institutions unlawfully to entrench himself in power.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the spokesman for the main opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The Bring Back Our Girls campaign, a right pressure group, has threatened to sue the Nigerian government for failing to provide information regarding the recent release of the Dapchi schoolgirls. The government says its back-channel negotiations with the militant group Boko Haram led to the release of the Dapchi girls, who were recently abducted by the militants. Meanwhile, in a meeting with the Dapchi girls Friday, President Muhammadu Buhari also threatened to name and shame those who benefit from the plight of the abducted schoolgirls. To learn more about the litigation threats, I reach Iman Shehu, a leading member of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Well, we decided that since there's a new situation, we also need to review our strategy. And we've decided that, added to what we've been doing before now, we will now go to court and ask the court to force the federal government to answer some pressing questions about the recent abduction and why the previous abduction, nothing has been done, even though there has been a report by the federal government which has not been acted upon.
Iman, does that mean that the question you are seeking forms part of the 14 questions that you asked the federal government to answer, of which some are saying the government has addressed, but the BBOG or your group appears not to be interested in the answers the government has given?
That the girls are back doesn't mean that something went terribly wrong, and that it happened after what had happened in Chibok shows we have a serious problem. So government needs to explain why this has happened again and what it is doing to ensure that it doesn't happen again. And it must also explain what it is doing to ensure that people are penalized for risking the lives of young Nigerian girls.
President Muhammadu Buhari assured the Dapchi girls in his meeting with them on Friday. Some are saying that is a strong indication of the government's preparedness to ensure protection of all Nigerians, including girls going to school.
Well, we had that before when the president took over. When we met him, he said it was unacceptable that Chibok happened, and then Dapchi has happened. So it's unacceptable that Dapchi has happened, and we will not wait until something else happens again. So that's why we're going to court.
When do you plan on going to court? Because it's the week is almost over. Next week ends. When do you plan on going, and when should Nigerians expect the suit?
As soon as our lawyers are ready with the issues that we're bringing before the court.
The president threatened when he met the Dapchi girls on Friday that he will name and shame those who are benefiting from these abductions by Boko Haram. Some critics of yours said that the Bring Back Our Girls campaign appears to be benefiting because the group has gained international recognition because of the plight of these abducted girls by Boko Haram, both in Chibok and recently the Dapchi girls who were released. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Well, it's natural for people to say we have gained, but they've not said how we have gained. What we have gained, of course, is international attention, and international pressure has worked in getting some Chibok girls back. And the fact that the federal government knows that as long as more girls are in the hands of Boko Haram and the campaign gets traction, it will be under enormous pressure. So if that is what the gains have translated into in ensuring the girls are back, I think we've made positive gains.
But are you convinced the government is doing everything it can to ensure the protection of Nigerians, particularly these young Nigerian girls who Boko Haram find attractive enough to abduct them. Are you convinced the government is keeping its word to protect these young girls?
That Chibok happened and that Dapchi happened again shows that the Nigerian military, the security services, and the government have not learned any lessons. And there is supposed to be a safe schools initiative. We do not know why the safe schools initiative has not been made effective. And we are also perplexed that the media, in the light of what has happened in Dapchi, has failed to investigate the safe schools initiative project. What has happened to all the funding of the safe schools initiative project?
Iman Shehu is a leading member of the Nigerian group Bring Back Our Girls campaign. He spoke with me from Abuja. Separatist violence in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon along the border with Nigeria have completely stalled trade between the two countries. Buses no longer ply the Bamenda-Enugu Road corridor as attacks and kidnappings continue. For VOA, Mokki Edwin Kenzeka visited some Cameroon border towns and has this report.
About 70 men and women have assembled at Kandem, a village in southwestern Cameroon, on the border with Nigeria, to discuss what to do with their farm produce and how to get supplies from neighboring Nigeria. 5 months ago, Kandem was a bustling market town along the $423 million African Development Bank-funded road linking Bamenda, Cameroon, with Enugu, Nigeria. Pierre Atemenge, who came from central Cameroon, opened a plantation in Kandem. He says constant conflicts between Cameroon government troops and armed separatists fighting for the independence of the English-speaking from the French-speaking regions of Cameroon have paralyzed business. He says 90% of the local farm produce has not been sold for the past 5 months.
Le mari s'occupe des cacao et le palmier. Et la femme s'occupe des vivres frais.
He says he has asked all men to store cocoa in their community warehouse while the women make sure that perishable farm produce like plantains, fresh maize and vegetables are harvested only when buyers come to their village. He says women have been asked to work in groups to be able to meet supply deadlines whenever demand will be high. Atemenge says goods imported from Nigeria are now difficult to come by, and when found, are very expensive. VOA boarded a commercial motorcycle to visit abandoned businesses in the village. Rider Lionel Mbung says the fighting has scared off the busloads of Nigerians that used to flood the village to buy farm produce and supply basic commodities, and that 80% of the youths in the village have fled the country. Lionel says he braved the crisis and stayed, but is now out of business after the government of Cameroon banned motorcycles because armed separatists were using the bikes to attack the military and kidnap government workers.
Since the situation in Cameroon started, the bike business have dropped down. There is no way for us. Things are not moving. They have passed order that they don't have to see any bikes. So we hide our bikes here. Then we go and look for passengers. Because when we go there with our bike, the police will catch us.
Access to most villages along the border with Nigeria is by motorcycle. The ban on their use has also helped to paralyze business. Paul Atanganji, Cameroon Minister of Territorial Administration, who ordered the ban, says the government will only reconsider its decision when peace returns and when an identification of the riders he has asked for is complete.
The population has complained time and again because most of them kidnap, kill, destroy. So we are asking them to put order in this profession.
Cameroon, with a population of about 23 million, depends on Nigeria for most basic commodities, and Nigeria's 160 million people count on Cameroon for rice, maize, tubers, plantain, cocoa, and other farm produce. The unrest in Cameroon began in November when English-speaking teachers and lawyers in the northwest and southwest regions, frustrated with having to work in French, took to the streets, calling for reforms and greater autonomy. Over the past year, armed separatist groups have emerged demanding all-out independence for the two English-speaking regions. The government says at least 30 soldiers and police have been killed in the recent clashes. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kandem, southwestern Cameroon.
For more on the crisis in Cameroon, Dr. Ebenezer Kwanga, the leader of the Southern Cameroon Defense Force, or SOCADEF, joins me live here in the studio. How are you, Ebenezer?
I'm okay.
You heard the report by Moki Edwin Kinzeka talking about the instability in part of Cameroon along the border with Nigeria. Businesses basically have ground to a halt. Some are blaming your group, SOCADEF, as being part of the problem of creating instability and such that businesses are being scared away. How do you respond to that?
Let me put it this way. First, thank you for welcoming me into your studio. Let me put it this way. You don't blame a girl child for wearing a short skirt for being responsible for rape on her person. The person who undertakes that rape, that act of rape, is somebody who has that within his bloodstream.
So who are you blaming now?
I'm blaming the system that thingified and annexed us. They push us into this situation. You understand the situation is very clear. No one was interested when we said there is a problem, let's resolve it. Until Biya told us that if we want peace, we must prepare for war. And we are ready for war. That is why we are where we are today. So you can't hold SOCADEF responsible. Biya and all his accolades are responsible for whatever atrocity, whether it's going to be economic pitfall or whatsoever is happening in that part of the world.
However, the people, women, children, elderly are being crossed, are being caught in the crossfire between the soldiers or security officials from the government and some armed groups, including yours. How do you resolve this stalemate?
The first thing I want you to know is that we are not fighting the soldiers of Cameroon. We're fighting terrorists. Cameroon don't have soldiers. They have terrorists.
Why do you call them terrorists?
Because the purpose of soldiers is to safeguard the national integrity of a country.
But they are protecting the territorial integrity of Cameroon.
By burning octogenarians, setting fire in a house, burning women who are 95 years old, beheading civilians that they have arrested. They can't deny that when the pictures, the images are out there. The facts are there. The UN can go and make its investigation. We're not making these things up. So we don't call them soldiers. We are fighting terrorists, just like the US is fighting terrorism, the UK and France. These guys are terrorists. They don't see us as human beings. They come into our homeland. They carry out what we call the Scotch F policy. They want to destroy everything, bend down everything. We have the right under international law to defend ourselves.
So what is the best way forward to resolve this instability in parts of Cameroon? Because the government maintains that Cameroon is one and indivisible, and that negotiations about the country's unity is non-negotiable.
No, we are not asking Biya whether it is negotiable or not. By the time he ran away from Dakar to come over and make a statement that is declaring war on us at the airport, it was because we started doing what he had asked us to do, prepare for war if we want peace. So the situation is simple. Every warlike situation ends up in a negotiated settlement. Okay? We are not going to give up our arms. We are looking for means to escalate this. We are not escalating it for any other reason but to force Biya and his terrorists and all those who back them to sit on the negotiating table and to start realizing that we deserve to live in this world as they are. We are human beings. So let's sit and talk. But we will not do that by folding our arms and let these guys carry out Scotch F on our entire territory. At the end of the day, when they finally cleanse each one of us, who will be there for them to negotiate with? So he can say it's non-negotiable. We are equally telling him that the issue of independence for the former British Southern Cameroons, present-day Ambazonia, is non-negotiable.
But you have a situation where there are different groups that come from the English-speaking parts of the country. Some want federalism. Others are saying, well, they want independence just like Sokadev does. How do you resolve your own internal problems without having a united front to achieve the objective that you have clearly spelled out?
You can't have a united front when there is war that is ongoing. You look at the situation of South Africa. Look at the situation of Mozambique or even Namibia. Look at the situation of even East Timor. East Timor did not have one group. There were about four different groups. One single group split it into four different groups. So people have the right to clamor for what they want. But if the regime in Yaounde, this terrorist regime, truly believes that there are people who are calling for federation and the rest, let them allow an international referendum to take place in our homeland where each one of us will be able to go to our people and lay down our case for either independence or federation. They don't want to do that because they know overwhelmingly what happened in South Sudan is what is going to happen in our own homeland. People will overwhelmingly choose total independence.
We'll continue some other time. Dr. Ebenezer Kwanga is the leader of the Southern Cameroon Defense Force, or SOCADEF. He joined me from here in Washington, D.C. A splinter group from the Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF party says it will announce its leadership structure after consultations that will ensure it has grassroots support. Called the National Patriotic Front, or NPF, the party is speculated to be the new political home for most former ZANU-PF members, aligned to former First Lady Grace Mugabe. Local media reports that the NPF has already registered with the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission to contest in the forthcoming July polls. To learn more about the new party, I read Zimbabwean political analyst Rejoice Ngwenya in the capital, Harare.
Well, Zimbabweans generally are amused by this because all along they thought, we thought that the G40 was just a faction within ZANU-PF. But now we know that it is desperate to seek a political identity. But of course, questions are being raised really where there is any difference in their political ideology. But of course, for the opposition, it's another mouth to feed in the very congested political competition field.
Robert Mugabe, the former president, is alleged to be one of the people that this group has been contacting for advice. And allegedly, the local media is reporting that he's asking them to focus on unity and broad national appeal. Will this party have any possible significant impact in the upcoming July elections?
Well, I doubt whether it is, because remember that Mugabe's legacy is a legacy of divisions and conflict. So it is very difficult to see how his advice can make any difference, because he's generally been a very divisive character and he's strenuously trying to distance himself from the actual structure of the party. But Zimbabweans are viewing his advice with a lot of suspicion, because he's not in a position ready to offer any sustainable and credible advice to any political outfit.
This is yet another party among a slew of opposition parties. Now, recently, talks are being made of a possible split within the ZANU-PFT party. Why all these parties? Wouldn't that give the ZANU-PF, and for that matter, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, the chance to win the presidential election?
Those observers from the perspective of opposition are simply saying that the National Front is going to divide the ZANU-PF, ballot, papers. It's not going to make any inroads into opposition. But really, the point is that if the National Party had not been set up, it was likely that those individuals who are not happy with Mnangagwa were definitely going to be voting for the MDC Alliance. But now there are really questions as to whether Mnangagwa himself can establish a majority, because it's unlikely. Given that the Alliance and Mujuru and the new National Front are now in the contestation. So really, it is going to be a really fragmented contest out there.
Is the Electoral Commission getting ready to organize this election? Because we understand soldiers from the Zimbabwe Defense Force have been deployed in parts of the country in readiness for the elections. Is this true, and how are Zimbabweans reacting to this development?
it is very difficult to substantiate, because what we know really is that Mnangagwa has been preaching the distinct possibility of a free, fair, and credible election. So if he's going to be seen to be deploying military people, it is going to be difficult for him to prove that the elections are credible, because men that are not in uniform are difficult to see. But for all I care, really, political competition is okay, because we know for certain that Mnangagwa will never have a majority he's been seeking. And it's likely that there's going to be a runoff between Mnangagwa and Chamisa. Mutiniri and Mujuru and even Togozani Kupe, I would say they are very, very distant from the epicenter of political victory.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the release of 3,000 prison inmates under a Zimbabwean presidential amnesty could have an impact on the upcoming elections. Yvonne Musarua was among those who were freed. She was an opposition party activist who was sentenced to 20 years in the high-profile slaying of a police officer in 2011. Some believe the case was politically motivated. For VOA reporter Kudzais Vanavashi has this report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Douglas Monzora, who is Secretary General for Zimbabwe's main opposition, Movement for Democratic Change, suggested that Musarura should run in the coming elections. Musarura said that's up to the party leadership. Musarura said after her release on Thursday that her will to fight for democracy and her belief in God kept her strong in prison.
I'm feeling happy to be released on this presidential pardon, but my happiness is not full because I'm not sure of the fate of my co-accused, Tungamirai Madzokera and Last Menga Ama. My wish is to see them also pardoned.
Elizabeth Banda, Assistant Commissioner of the Zimbabwe Prisons and Correctional Services, cited prison overcrowding as a key factor in the amnesty.
It is decongestion of the prisons. You find that our holding capacity as Zimbabwe Prisons and Correctional Service is 17,000. But currently, as at yesterday, we had 19,945 inmates, which is way above our holding capacity.
Banda explains the selection process for the amnesty.
Firstly, we're looking at the remission of sentence of all convicted female inmates. Then we also had remission of sentence of all juveniles. We're looking at those juveniles who are below the age of 18. We also have remission of sentence for prisoners sentenced to 36 months and below. For this, a full remission of the period remaining is hereby granted to all those prisoners sentenced to the period of 36 months and below. And those should have saved a quarter of their sentence.
She adds that all death penalties were converted to life, in line with President Emmerson Mnangagwa's strong stance against capital punishment when he was vice president. Amnesty International has commended the move. Habitual criminals and those who previously benefited from an amnesty but went on to commit crimes were excluded from the release. Hospital and prisons care President Reverend Isaac Silumbu says churches have a mammoth task to preach unity and reconciliation so the pardoned inmates can reintegrate into society. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Although cancer is one of the leading causes of death worldwide, the World Health Organization reports that colorectal cancer is one of the cancers that we can actually prevent. VOA's Carol Pearson has more on that and the story of a woman who beat colon cancer.
The colon is a long muscular tube that's also known as the large intestine. It processes undigested food. Colon cancer is linked to diet, genetic predisposition, and age. In the U.S., 1 in 23 people will be told they have colon cancer. Michelle Alexander got her diagnosis at age 53.
You know, how much longer do I have? My daughter's 24. You know, she's still got a lot of her life left. How much longer will I be with her? But those kind of thoughts go through your head.
Dr. Jiha Wu at the University of Missouri Healthcare says this type of cancer is largely preventable.
The majority of the colon cancer develop from a benign polyp, and that takes about 10, 15 years. So if you find a polyp and remove them, then you won't have colon cancer. So it's very important to have a screening to prevent cancer.
As scary as her diagnosis was, Alexander's passion for auto racing helped her get through her ordeal. Her favorite driver is Carl Edwards, and she had tickets to a race where he was competing. When someone shared her story with him, he called her.
And I said, there's an auction, or I can bid to ride in the truck with you for driver intros, and it is my goal to win that auction. And he said, don't bid. You get here, you're riding with me.
6 weeks after surgery to remove the cancer in her colon, Alexander got her ride.
Oh, it was just joy. Won a race with my life and crossed the finish line the winner.
Wu said Alexander's attitude helped.
She wanted to get better. She had this strong will to get better, and I think that it's very important.
Doctors say you can help prevent colon cancer if you eat plenty of greens, whole grains, and vegetables like beans and legumes, which are high in fiber. Regular exercise also helps, and if you smoke, stop. Most importantly, get a regular screening starting at age 50 or sooner if you have a family history. If colon cancer is diagnosed at an early stage, the World Health Organization says 90% of patients survive at least 5 years, compared to no more than 8% of those diagnosed at an advanced stage. 2 years after her surgery, Alexander is still cancer-free and still a race car enthusiast. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, there was a CAF Champions League group draw in Cairo on Wednesday. Holders Wydad Casablanca of Morocco have pulled debutants AS Sport of Togo. They are in Group C with 2016 winners Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and Horoya of Guinea. Record winners Al Ahly of Egypt are in Group A alongside Esperance of Tunisia. This group also includes debutants Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority, KCCA, and Botswana's Township Rollers. Congolese giants TP Mazembe in Group B with former winners Algeria's Etent Setif, Maldia's Alga of Algeria, Difa El Jadidi of Morocco are also in this same group. In Group D, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia will face Angola's Primeiro de Agosto, Zesco United of Zambia, as well as newcomers Mbabane Swallows of Swaziland. The group phases will kick off on the weekend of May 6th to 8th. CAF also held draws for the Confederation Cup playoffs. Thus, the Champions League groups are as follows. Group A has Al Ahly of Egypt, Township Rollers of Botswana, KCCA of Uganda, and Esperance de Tunis of Tunisia. Group B has TP Mazembe of DR Congo, Maloudia Alga of Algeria, Difa El Jadid of Morocco, and Etent Setif of Algeria. Group C has AS Port of Togo, Mamelodi Sundowns South Africa, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco, and Horoya of Guinea. And Group D has Zesco United of Zambia, Primeiro de Agosto of Angola, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia, and Mbabane Swallows of Swaziland. And in athletics, Ethiopia's Netsanet Gudeta broke Kenya's dominance in the World Half Marathon Championships by smashing the women's only race world record in Valencia, Spain on Saturday. Kenyan women had swept the medals at the previous two championships, but Gudeta pushed on alone from 15 kilometers to win in a time of 1 hour, 6 minutes and 11 seconds. The 27-year-old finished a comfortable 43 seconds ahead of Kenyan Jocelyn Jepkosgei, who holds the overall world record of 1 hour, 4 minutes and 51 seconds. Jepkosgei's compatriot, Paulina Kamulu, came third. The previous record for a single-sex race was set by Lona Iplagat in Udine, Italy in 2007. Earlier, Geoffrey Camoro won his third consecutive title in the men's event at a time of 1 hour 2 seconds. The Kenyan, who won silver in the 10,000 meters at the 2015 World Championships in Beijing, was followed over the line by Abraham Cheruben of Bahrain and Aaron Kifle of Eritrea. And in tennis, Roger Federer will lose his world number one spot after defeat at the Miami Open and has announced he will miss the clay court season, including the French Open. The 36-year-old, who suffered a shock 3-6, 6-3, 7-6 loss to world number 175, Thanasi Kokkinakis in Miami, did not play on clay last season either. The Swiss will be replaced by Rafael Nadal at the top of the new rankings. Federer, who won his 20th Grand Slam at the Australian Open in January, began in typical assured style but was worn down by Australian qualifier Kokkinakis, who won in 2 hours and 21 minutes. It was Federer's second loss in 6 days. He saw a 17-match unbeaten run come to an end in a grueling match with Juan Martin De La Potro in Indian Wells last weekend. Also, world number one Simone Halep was knocked out in the third round of the Miami Open by Agnieszka Radwańska. Romania's 26-year-old Halep lost 3-6, 6-2, 6-3 as the 32nd-ranked Pole came from behind to win in 1 hour 44 minutes. Halep had fought back from a set down to defeat Frances Ossendaldin in the previous round. Meanwhile, former world number one Karolina Pliskova needed 3 tough sets to battle past Sei Shu Wei 6-4, 1-6, 7-6 and reach the last 16. It was the first time Pliskova has faced Hayes, who knocked out Garbiñe Muguruza on her way to reaching the last 16 at the Austrian Open. 3-time winner Victoria Anzereka moved into the fourth round with a 3-6, 6-4, 6-1 win over 20th seed Anastasija Sevastova of Latvia. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Anytime that you're feeling down, mama say, girl, make you settle down, no. Tell her, say, I don't get you down, no. With the smile, make you know the frown, no. Say, no one can pull you down, no. So me sing, say, win, win, win. Win, win, win. We go there.
Combo you, oh. Win, win, win. nimethibitisha macho, lakini moyo unakataa. Nimeamini kikulacho ni yule unaona anayekufaa. Nilifumba mboni zangu kwa wengine nimuone yetu, nikamwaga jasho langu.
Mejitahidi sana wenda siku mbidhisha labda, ila kinachochanganya hakuna mbia kabla. Sina nakupa maua peleke, usijia tupa na umbao ya poke. Oh, na suna ntafunga siku ni waunge. Ape baraka mumba watoto walete.
Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Hello, Dr. Jorah.
Good evening, Africa. In 2009, at the ministerial meeting of AGOA in Kenya, former Secretary of State, United States, Hillary Clinton, surprised the delegates when she regretted that African intra-African trade was so low. She asserted that only a few percentage increase intra-African trade would result in the increase of the gross domestic product, and Africa would not need so much foreign economic assistance. At that time, some commentators poo-pooed the idea on the ground that although the dream of having free trade from Cape to Cairo has long been, it would be difficult to achieve that goal. Now, 9 years after that pitch in Kenya, African states are attempting to achieve the goal. Last week, at an extraordinary summit meeting in Kigali, Rwanda, hosted by President Kagame, in the presence of the African Union Commission Chair, Musa Faki Mohamed, an agreement was signed called African Continental Free Trade Area by 44 of the 55 African Union member states. Nigeria, which was set to sign, had to withhold its signature because President Buhari said that the unions and the business community complained they had not been sufficiently consulted. But it is possible for the rest of the African states to sign and to ratify the agreement at a later stage. It is the hope that this agreement, when sufficiently signed and ratified, should come into effect either towards the end of this year or sometime next year. It will maybe a very major market of 1.2 billion people with a total economic strength of $2.2 trillion. So this would be highly significant and should be able to boost African economic development. Of course, there will be difficulties on the way. It is normal for any trade agreement to have hiccups, such as what we discovered with the labor unions in Nigeria and the business community. But each member state would have to iron this out in the countries and to accelerate the process to have this trade agreement functioning. There will also need to be infrastructure developments to allow the free movement of trade. Of course, this intra-African trade agreement is only the first stage. The next would be to move to a custom union and later to a common market. But bear in mind that it took the European Union so many years to move through this stage. But there is no doubt that this would be very important for Africa if it should be achieved. Currently, intra-African trade is only ranging around 16%. In Asia, it is over 50%. And in Europe, of course, it's over 80%. This agreement signed in Kigali will remove tariffs in 90% of African trade. 10% will remain to be tackled later on. So this will go on progressively. It is not going to be easy for some African countries, particularly Nigeria and South Africa. But hopefully the commitment to African unity and the commitment to African prosperity will convince them to join. It is really surprising that Africa has so much wealth and yet not properly utilized. Just trading directly to outside countries has not been very helpful to the African countries. So let us hope that this first step by the African states will finally help the African people, particularly youth, to find jobs and to increase their economic strength. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jorah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. We'll be right back.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who speaks does not know that the listener is smart. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, is in the midst of one of the largest and most serious humanitarian crises in the world. About 4.5 million people have been displaced by violence, and 13.1 million need humanitarian assistance. America sees the humanitarian crisis in the DRC as an urgent priority for several reasons, said USAID Administrator Mark Green. First, the United States has provided millions of dollars to the DRC to alleviate suffering and foster economic development. But they are being robbed of their full value by crisis, conflict, and poor governance, said Administrator Green. Man-made disaster in the form of inhumane authoritarian governance is destroying any chance that these purposes will be met. Second, this is an international crisis. Brutal policies, sweeping corruption, poor governance, and simmering conflict have displaced millions. Hundreds of thousands have fled into neighboring countries, imposing new burdens and risking regional instability. Third, the scope of suffering is breathtaking. And while it's true that the situation in the DRC is complex, that is no excuse to not act. We may not have all the answers, but we do know what isn't working, the status quo, said Mark Green. Therefore, we suggest taking the following steps. First, the DRC must hold credible elections this calendar year. Second, the government must foster conditions that make true democracy possible, including immediately making clear to citizens that they are free to express their will and choose their own future. Third, the government must guarantee the safety of humanitarian workers. Last year, 158 security incidents targeting humanitarian workers were reported. Two UN experts were abducted and killed. And finally, because an international crisis requires an international response, we call on other countries to step forward and do more to help. This demand begins with the government itself. It has done so little to alleviate suffering, even as many of its leaders have apparently been lining their own pockets, said Administrator Green. True compassion requires more than providing money. It requires us to use our collective influence to demand concrete actions that will end cycles of misery. We call for these demands because they will offer the people of DRC their first real hope of a brighter future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.